This is a young man that I met, like I say, in Prague. I had heard of him before, and we never got a chance to get together. He has a very full agenda. I have a very full agenda. But he was on my agenda. This is a guy I got to meet, and I got to hit. And he's the gentleman who started the INR Institute and has held the conference himself, has others in the mill, has brought together the compendium of knowledge on initiatives and the litigation that's gone forward in initiatives. There's a saying that, you know, the reason why we make mistakes is because we forget history. And it's important to know the past because it's a guide to the future. We shouldn't become slaves to the past, but it's a guide to the future. And so what he's brought together is just awesome in its contribution to what we're all about. And so I would like to introduce a young man who I think has made a singular contribution to the nation and what he's done. And that, of course, is Dane Waters. And that's a young man that I personally like as a personal friend. Dane, come on up here.
The Initiative and Referendum Institute is an organization that's dedicated to the study of the initiative and referendum process. We take no position on any specific ballot measure. But what we have tried to do since 1998 is just collect the raw data about what's going on around the world, around the country, about the initiative and referendum process. The actually, an interesting thing is I was on National Public Radio last year talking about ballot measures, and I was talking about how the initiative process has been used, and I brought up the fact that margarine is now yellow because of the initiative process. How many of you knew that out there? There you go. Todd knows that. Todd and Carolyn actually know a lot more about this process than I ever will know. But I was talking about that on NPR, that margarine is yellow because of the initiative process. We talked about 15 minutes about it. The very next day, I got a call from NPR in a panic saying that the National Margarine Association called, swearing that that was not the case, saying that margarine is not yellow, that they never used the initiative process. So I actually had to go through the records and find it and, you know, send it to NPR, and they called the Margarine Association to prove that to the Margarine Association that margarine is yellow today because of the initiative process. But that actually points out why the initiative process was so important and why it came about, because, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about the Founding Fathers and what a wonderful document they created. And I believe that they created a wonderful document, but as was stated, it was a document based on compromise. So when the populists and progressives came along in the 1890s, they said, hey, listen, this is a wonderful document. However, the special interests are now controlling the legislature. The dairy industry is controlling the legislature. You know, railroads are controlling the legislature. So what is the option? What do we have to do? We're blocked out of the system. So they, in the tradition of our founding fathers, proposed a new system, which is the initiative and referendum process. You know, they never envisioned, and they had no desire to replace representative government, even though there were some in the movement during that period of time who wanted pure direct democracy. But the overriding theme was not to replace representative democracy or representative government, but to put in place a mechanism that would enhance representative government, which is why we have the initiative and referendum process. So I'm going to take actually just a couple of minutes and talk about how the process has been used, clarify some points. There's a lot of misinformation about the initiative process out there. I remember specifically I had the honor, if you want to call it that, of meeting with Governor Ventura a couple of years ago when there was an initiative bill being considered in Minnesota, which I'll talk about in a minute. And even though he has said publicly that he supported the initiative process, the first thing out of his mouth was, well, I'm concerned that we're going to end up with hundreds of initiatives on the ballot every election cycle. You know, look at California. They voted on hundreds of initiatives every election cycle. Well, that simply isn't true. The fact of the matter is that since the inception of the statewide initiative process in the United States, the first statewide initiative appeared on the ballot in Oregon in 1904, there have been approximately 1,923 statewide initiatives ever on the ballot. Of that number, the citizens have adopted 821. So think about it. In 100 years, the citizens using the initiative process have adopted a little over 800 laws. Now, there's a little statistic in the paper here that talks about 1996 being the high water mark for the use of the initiative process. In 1996, God forbid, but the citizens put 102 statewide initiatives on the ballot. And the citizens adopted 45, or about 44%. So in 1996, the citizens made 45 laws using the initiative process. In contrast, that year, state legislatures in those same 24 states adopted over 14,000 laws and resolutions. You know, it's an overused process. The citizens in one year make 45 laws, and the legislatures make 14,000 just in those 24 states, and they complain it's an overused process. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. And also, I want to quote a couple of studies here by Dave McCune, for example, out of California, that talks about in California, according to Dave McCune, only 26% of all initiatives filed have made it to the ballot, and only 8% of those filed actually were adopted by the voters. It's very difficult to qualify an initiative for the ballot. Bob Stern, who's a very good friend of mine, talks about how if you have $1 million that you can pretty much put any, well, there's a guarantee that, you know, you can put anything on the ballot. First of all, I would argue with the money-back guarantee. I can't imagine that Angelo and Mike Arno would make a money-back guarantee like that. But, yes, you have a very good chance of putting an initiative on the ballot if you have $1 million. But there actually are no guarantees. From my experiences, you know, prior to the Institute, I worked for an organization called U.S. Term Limits, and yes, we spent a lot of money to put issues on the ballot, but that was no guarantee that we were going to make it to the ballot. So let's talk about what is currently going on with the initiative process. Since the inception of the process, as I said, the citizens have made 821 laws, but those initiatives are very controversial, at least in the minds of state legislators. You have term limits, tax limitations, campaign finance reforms, lobbying restrictions, lobbying reforms. Many of the initiatives that have been appeared on the ballot and that have passed are the issues that directly affect the power of state legislators and state lawmakers. So lo and behold, for some reason, now they hate the initiative process. So what has happened, unfortunately, is since basically 1990, as much as I love term limits, the unfortunate result of the term limit movement has been that there's definitely been a trend to regulate the initiative process across the country. Those regulations have ranged from increasing the number of signatures required to put an issue on the ballot, decreasing the circulation period like Missouri did in the last election cycle. They decreased the circulation period by 2 months, which, taking the two best circulating months out, June and July, when all the state, you know, the state fairs take place. Idaho, where they increased the distribution requirement, which I'm happy to say that the Institute was able to strike down in federal court as being unconstitutional. State of Mississippi, which not only changed the requirement that you had to be a registered voter and a resident of the state to circulate petitions, but they made it retroactive. And they made it retroactive because of term limits, because term limit initiative had made the ballot, so the legislature says, well, we don't want term limits, so let's go out there and we'll adopt this change to the initiative law, making it retroactive, so therefore the initiative would be thrown off the ballot. But thanks to the federal courts down there, they struck the retroactivity out as unconstitutional, so term limits were allowed to stay on the ballot down there. In the state of Utah, in addition to term limits, there's been an outcry against the initiative process because of the animal protection movement. In states like Utah and Wyoming and Idaho, where there's a large hunting population, the animal protection people or animal rights people have been very successful in putting initiatives on the ballot. So in Utah, the state legislature, they were concerned about that. So they passed a change that said that it drastically increased the distribution requirements, which means you have to get so many signatures from such a certain area of constituency. But they also said that any initiative pertaining to the taking of wildlife must pass by 2/3 vote of the people. That's the only issue. So if you want to do an animal rights initiative in the state of Utah, 2/3 of the people have to pass it, whereas everything else requires a simple majority. Oklahoma is another example where the state legislature, believe it or not, cockfighting is actually still legal in several states in this country. It's an issue very near to my heart. But in Oklahoma, the state legislature and the cockfighters there, apparently it's a big tradition there. So The Animal Protection Group put an initiative on the ballot, or tried to put an initiative on the ballot, that would ban cockfighting. Well, they challenged the signatures and dragged the whole process out, but eventually it has qualified for the ballot, which will be voted on this November, but it's taken 4 years to get to the ballot. But in the meantime, the legislature passed a constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot this November that requires twice as many signatures for any initiative pertaining to the taking of wildlife as any other measure. So if the cockfighting measure is defeated at the ballot box, if they want to come back and try to do it again, they have to get twice the number of signatures for that specific issue than for any other issue. My concern is that's just the first step in adding that same regulation to all types of initiatives, whether it's term limits, tax limitations, campaign finance reform, environmental reform, or whatever. That is my concern. There's definitely a drive out there to not take away the initiative process, because state lawmakers, you know, they don't have the guts to just come out and say, listen, I don't want this process. But what they are doing, they are regulating it to a point that the average citizen cannot use the process. That goes back to California. I mean, it's unfortunate that somebody has to spend $1 million to use the initiative process in California. It's unfortunate, but it's a reality and it's a necessity, because the process has become so regulated in many states that the only people who have access to the ballot are people who have access to money. Now, I'm not scared of money. I'm not scared of people with money. But at the same time, only those people with access to money can use the initiative process, which is of great concern to me. There's not a single state out there in which lawmakers have made the initiative process easier. They have done nothing but make it more difficult. Groups who oppose the initiative process, as I talked about yesterday, are the National Rifle Association, the Eagle Forum, and interesting enough, the unions. I mean, the initiative process exists today because of the support of the unions. I mean, they wanted labor laws, changes in labor laws. So they were strong advocates during the progressive and popular era of the initiative process. But now, they are adamantly opposed to it because of reforms like school choice, changes in education, you know, things that they don't like. The initiative process, the difficulty in expanding the initiative process today is because there is the history of how the process has been used. A lot of people say today, well, you know, you had 19 states between 1898 and 1912 adopt the initiative process, and state legislatures did it. Why is it so difficult today? Well, it's difficult today because lawmakers see that as soon as the initiative process is adopted in a state, it will be used for reforms that they don't like. I want to take a minute now and talk about the future of the initiative process. Expanding the process is going to be very difficult. However, there is definitely a strong movement now in Minnesota, thanks to Paul Jacob and a new group called Citizens in Charge, working with Representative Eric Paulson up there to try to expand the initiative process. Minnesota has had the unfortunate honor of having INR on their ballot 3 times, but it was defeated 3 times, not because the voters voted against it, but they have this requirement that 60% of all those voting in the election must vote on the measure, something along those lines. And so even though the initiative measure passed sometimes 3-1, not enough individuals who voted for governor, for example, voted on the amendment. Now, there's an interesting story that early on, one of the reasons for that is that the way the polling booths were in Minnesota is that INR was located at the very top of the ballot. So short individuals could not vote for the measure. So that is why it did not get enough votes to pass early on. Maybe, Paul, you should buy footstools for everybody in Minnesota so they can vote for it next time. But there definitely are current attacks on the initiative process. And I want to say here that you know, the reason I'm here is to talk about the current initiative and referendum process. I mean, I spend pretty much all my time talking about and collecting information on how the process is being attacked. Lawmakers are definitely trying to take it away. And not only are they trying to take it away, they are, not only is it trying to be taken away, the possibilities for expanding it, as I talked about, it's very, very difficult. I also want to take a moment and thank the governor of New York, Governor Pataki, who actually said in his State of the State address that he wants a constitutional amendment for initiative and referendum. I mean, I applaud those efforts. But I've said also in the past that numerous governors have come out and said they support INR, but have never spent the political capital to actually make it happen. You have Governor Foster of Louisiana, Governor Bush of Texas, when he was governor, actually He supported INR in the election. When he was elected governor, even though he says he supported it, the state Republican Party took the pro-INR plank out of the party platform and put an anti-INR plank in it while he was governor of Texas. Now, he says he has no control over the Republican Party platform in Texas. I find that surprising. But Governor Ridge of Pennsylvania proposed it. Governor Ventura of Minnesota proposed it. Governor Foster of Louisiana, as I said. Governor Pataki, actually in 1995, I believe, proposed it. There are numerous governors that have proposed it in the past, but they have yet to spend the political capital necessary to make it happen. The only way the initiative process has become a reality across the country is because of the role of the governors in these states. Governor Hiram Johnson of California, Colorado. John Shafroth of Colorado. I mean, it's one of the greatest legacies that these governors have. And so I would encourage those people who live in states without the initiative process, I guess that my time limit's up, is that you talk to your governors. That's the way, the only way, to get the process expanded. But real quick, a couple of the assaults on the process. In 1998, the United States Postal Service passed a prohibition on collecting signatures on postal property. Now, that is a major impediment to the initiative process, especially in rural states like Idaho, Montana, I don't pick Mississippi, other rural states that have distribution requirements. It's amazing to me that the U.S. Postal Service has claimed that you cannot collect signatures on postal property. They also claim they're not a governmental agency, yet we have sued them, and the people representing them are the Justice Department. So I find that interesting that a governmental agency has the Justice Department defending them, a non-governmental agency, supposedly. State of Montana is changing their distribution requirements. That's going to be on the November ballot. Another thing that I find quite interesting is the role of the courts. Now, I'm an advocate of the judicial system from the standpoint that the judiciary is the check and balance on the initiative process. Sometimes they, in my opinion, abuse that power, but that's, of course, in the eyes of the beholder. But in Oregon, the court ruled, they struck term limits down in the state of Oregon after term limits passed 10 years ago because they're claiming that term limits violated the single amendment provision of the initiative process in the state of Oregon 10 years later. They're doing the same thing. I'm predicting they're going to do the same thing in the state of Montana. So you now have courts going back over 10 years to initiatives that passed 10 years ago, striking them down because they violate some technical provision of the state's INR law, saying it violates the single amendment provision. So is there a fine line between supporting the judiciary and as the check and balance on the INR process, but at the same time, you have to watch them very closely to make sure they don't overstep those bounds. So in summing up, the initiative process, I mean, I could go on and on for hours, which several speakers have, but just kidding. But there's a lot to talk about. I mean, our website, www.indrinstitute.org, has a lot of information about the initiative process if you want to get that information. But I want to take a minute to commend what Mike is doing and Don Kimner is doing and People's Lobby is doing. I mean, it's definitely an uphill battle. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I'm a strong advocate of the national initiative process and the national referendum process. Getting there is going to definitely be a long road, but you have to take these incremental steps to get there. And I must commend Mike for thinking outside the box. I mean, some of the proposals I'm not exactly totally supportive of, just like some of us. But it takes this first step to get us in that direction of possibly getting a national initiative and referendum process, and I must congratulate them on thinking outside the box. So thank you for having me here today.